Chapter 36. Corpse said, "Never mind. Shake him up some kind of a box he could stretch out in comfortable. He weren't particular about the general style of it. Said he went more on room than style, anyway, in a last final container. Friends wanted a silver door plate on the coffin, signifying who he was, and where he was from. Now you know a fellow couldn't roust out such a gaily thing as that in a little country town like this. What did Corpse say?"
Corpse said, "Whitewash his old canoe and daub his address and general destination onto it with a blacking brush and a stencil plate, along with a verse from some likely hymn or other, and paint him for the tomb, and mark him 100. O.D., and just let him flicker. He weren't distressed any more than you be, on the contrary, just as circa, a man collected as a hearse horse, said he judged that where he was going to a body, would find it considerable better, to attract attention by a picturesque moral character than a natty burial case with a swell door plate on it. Splendid man, he was. I'd ruther do for a corpse like that than any I've tackled in 7 year. There's some satisfaction in burying a man like that. You feel that what you're doing is appreciated. Lord bless you, so's he got planted before he spilled, he was perfectly satisfied. Said his relations meant well, perfectly well, but all them preparations was bound to delay the thing more or less, and he didn't wish to be kept laying around. You never see such a clear head as what he had, and so circa, a man so cool. Just a hunk of brains, that is what he was. Perfectly awful. It was a ripping distance from one end of that man's head to t'other. Often and over again he's had brain fever raging in one place, and the rest of the pile didn't know anything about it, didn't affect it any more than an engine insurrection in Arizona affects the Atlantic states. The relations, they wanted a big funeral, but Corpse said he was down on flummery, didn't he want any procession, fill the hearse full of mourners, and get out a stern line, and tow him behind. He was the most down on style of any remains I ever struck. A beautiful, simple-minded creature it was what he was, you can depend on that. He was just set on having things the way he wanted them, and he took a solid comfort in laying his little plans. He had me measure him, and take a whole raft of directions. Then he had the minister stand up behind the long box with a tablecloth over it, to represent the coffin, and read his funeral sermon, saying anchor, anchor, apostrophe, apostrophe at the good places, and making him scratch out every bit of brag about him, and all the hephaleton. And then he made them trot out the choir, so's he could help them pick out the tunes for the occasion, and he got them to sing Pop Goes the Weasel, apostrophe, because he'd always liked that tune when he was downhearted, and solemn music made him sad. And when they sung that with tears in their eyes, because they all loved him, and his relations grieving around, he just laid there as happy as a bug, and trying to beat time and showing all over how much he enjoyed it. And presently he got worked up and excited, and tried to join in, for, mind you, he was pretty proud of his abilities in the singing line. But the first time he opened his mouth, and was just going to spread himself, his breath took a walk. I never see a man snuffed out so sudden. Ah, it was a great loss, a powerful loss to this poor little one-horse town. Well, 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 I ain't got time to be palavering along here, got to nail on the lid and mosey along with him, and if he'll just give me a lift we'll skeet him into the hearse and meander along. Relations bound to have it, so don't pay no attention to dying injunctions, minute a corpse is gone. But, if I had my way, if I didn't respect his last wishes, and tow him behind the hearse I'll be cussed. I consider that whatever a corpse wants done for his comfort is little enough matter, and a man ain't got no right to deceive him, or take advantage of him. And whatever a corpse trusts me to do I'm a-going to do, you know, even if it's to stuff him, and paint him yaller, and keep him for a keepsake, you hear me? He cracked his whip, and went lumbering away with his ancient ruin of a hearse, and I continued my walk with a valuable lesson learned that a healthy and wholesome cheerfulness is not necessarily impossible to any occupation. The lesson is likely to be lasting, for it will take many months to obliterate the memory of the remarks and circumstances that impressed it. Concerning chambermaids, against all chambermaids, of whatsoever age or nationality, I launch the curse of bachelordom. Because they always put the pillows at the opposite end of the bed from the gas burner, so that while you read and smoke before sleeping, as is the ancient and honored custom of bachelors, you have to hold your book aloft in an uncomfortable position to keep the light from dazzling your eyes. When they find the pillows removed to the other end of the bed in the morning, they receive not the suggestion in a friendly spirit, but, glorying in their absolute sovereignty, and unpitying your helplessness, they make the bed just as it was originally, and gloat in secret over the pang their tyranny will cause you. Always after that, when they find you have transposed the pillows, they undo your work, and thus defy, and seek to embitter the life that God has given you. If they cannot get the light in an inconvenient position any other way, they move the bed. If you pull your trunk out 6 inches from the wall, so that the lid will stay up when you open it, they always shove that trunk back again. They do it on purpose. If you want the spittoon in a certain spot, where it will be handy, they don't, and so they move it. They always put your other boots in two inaccessible places. They chiefly enjoy depositing them as far under the bed as the wall will permit. It is because this compels you to get down in an undignified attitude and make wild sweeps for them in the dark with the bootjack, and swear. They always put the matchbox in some other place. They hunt up a new place for it every day, and put up a bottle, or other perishable glass thing, where the box stood before. This is to cause you to break that glass thing, groping in the dark, and get yourself into trouble. They are forever and ever moving the furniture. When you come in the night, you can calculate on finding the bureau where the wardrobe was in the morning. And when you go out in the morning, if you leave the slop bucket by the door and rocking chair by the window, when you come in at midnight or thereabout, you will fall over that rocking chair, and you will proceed toward the window, and sit down in that slop tub. This will disgust you. They like that. No matter where you put anything, they are not going to let it stay there. They will take it and move it the first chance they get. It is their nature. And, besides, it gives them pleasure to be mean and contrary this way. They would die if they couldn't be villains. They always save up all the old scraps of printed rubbish you throw on the floor, and stack them up carefully on the table, and start the fire with your valuable manuscripts. If there is any one particular old scrap that you are more down on than any other, and which you are gradually wearing your life out trying to get rid of, you may take all the pains you possibly can in that direction, but it won't be of any use, because they will always fetch that old scrap back and put it in the same old place again every time. It does them good. And they use up more hair oil than any 6 men. If charged with purloining the same, they lie about it. What do they care about a hereafter? Absolutely nothing. If you leave the key in the door for convenience sake, they will carry it down to the office and give it to the clerk. They do this under the vile pretense of trying to protect your property from thieves, but actually they do it because they want to make you tramp back downstairs after it when you come home tired, or put you to the trouble of sending a waiter for it, which waiter will expect you to pay him something. In which case I suppose the degraded creatures divide. They keep always trying to make your bed before you get up, thus destroying your rest and inflicting agony upon you, but after you get up, they don't come any more till next day. They do all the mean things they can think of, and they do them just out of pure cussedness, and nothing else. Chambermaids are dead to every human instinct. If I can get a bill through the legislature abolishing chambermaids, I mean to do it. Aurelia's Unfortunate Young Man, written about 1865. The facts in the following case came to me by letter from a young lady who lives in the beautiful city of San Jose. She is perfectly unknown to me, and simply signs herself Aurelia Maria, which may possibly be a fictitious name. But no matter, the poor girl is almost heartbroken by the misfortunes she has undergone, and so confused by the conflicting counsels of misguided friends and insidious enemies, that she does not know what course to pursue in order to extricate herself from the web of difficulties in which she seems almost hopelessly involved. In this dilemma she turns to me for help, and supplicates for my guidance and instruction with a moving eloquence that would touch the heart of a statue. Hear her sad story. She says that when she was 16 years old she met and loved, with all the devotion of a passionate nature, a young man from New Jersey, named Williamson Breckinridge Carruthers, who was some 6 years her senior. They were engaged, with the free consent of their friends and relatives, and for a time it seemed as if their career was destined to be characterized by an immunity from sorrow beyond the usual lot of humanity. But at last the tide of fortune turned. Young Carruthers became infected with smallpox of the most virulent type, and when he recovered from his illness his face was pitted like a waffle mold, and his comeliness gone forever. Aurelia thought to break off the engagement at first, but pity for her unfortunate lover caused her to postpone the marriage day for a season, and give him another trial. The very day before the wedding was to have taken place, Breckinridge, while absorbed in watching the flight of a balloon, walked into a well, and fractured one of his legs, and it had to be taken off above the knee. Again Aurelia was moved to break the engagement, but again love triumphed, and she set the day forward, and gave him another chance to reform. And again misfortune overtook the unhappy youth. He lost one arm by the premature discharge of a 4th of July cannon, and within 3 months he got the other pulled out by a carding machine. Aurelia's heart was almost crushed by these latter calamities. She could not, but be deeply grieved to see her lover passing from her by piecemeal, feeling, as she did, that he could not last forever under this disastrous process of reduction, yet knowing of no way to stop its dreadful career, and in her tearful despair she almost regretted, like brokers who hold on and lose, that she had not taken him at first, before he had suffered such an alarming depreciation. Still, her brave soul bore her up, and she resolved to bear with her friend's unnatural disposition, yet a little longer. Again the wedding day approached, and again disappointment overshadowed it. Carruthers fell ill with the erysipelas, and lost the use of one of his eyes entirely. The friends and relatives of the bride, considering that she had already put up with more than could reasonably be expected of her, now came forward, and insisted that the match should be broken off. But after wavering a while, Aurelia, with a generous spirit which did her credit, said she had reflected calmly upon the matter, and could not discover that Breckinridge was to blame. So she extended the time once more, and he broke his other leg. It was a sad day for the poor girl when she saw the surgeons reverently bearing away the sack whose uses she had learned by previous experience, and her heart told her the bitter truth, that some more of her lover was gone. She felt that the field of her affections was growing more and more circumscribed every day, but once more she frowned down her relatives and renewed her betrothal. Shortly before the time set for the nuptials another disaster occurred. There was but one man scalped by the Owens River Indians last year. That man was Williamson Breckinridge Carruthers of New Jersey. He was hurrying home with happiness in his heart, when he lost his hair forever, and in that hour of bitterness he almost cursed the mistaken mercy that had spared his head. At last Aurelia is in serious perplexity as to what she ought to do. She still loves her Breckinridge, she writes, with truly womanly feeling she still loves what is left of him but her parents are bitterly opposed to the match, because he has no property, and is disabled from working, and he has not sufficient means to support both comfortably. Ah, what should she do? She asked with painful and anxious solicitude. It is a delicate question. It is one which involves the lifelong happiness of a woman, and that of nearly two-thirds of a man, and I feel that it would be assuming too great a responsibility to do more than make a mere suggestion in the case. How would it do to build to him? If Aurelia can afford the expense, let her furnish her mutilated lover with wooden arms and wooden legs, and a glass eye and a wig, and give him another show. Give him 90 days, without grace, and if he does not break his neck in the meantime, marry him and take the chances. It does not seem to me that there is much risk, anyway, Aurelia, because if he sticks to his singular propensity for damaging himself every time he sees a good opportunity, his next experiment is bound to finish him, and then you are safe, married or single. If married, the wooden legs and such other valuables as he may possess revert to the widow, and you see you sustain no actual loss save the cherished fragment of a noble, but most unfortunate husband, who honestly strove to do right, but whose extraordinary instincts were against him. Try it, Maria. I have thought the matter over carefully and well, and it is the only chance I see for you. It would have been a happy conceit on the part of Carruthers, if he had started with his neck and broken that first, but since he has seen fit to choose a different policy and string himself out as long as possible, I do not think we ought to upbraid him for it, if he has enjoyed it. We must do the best we can under the circumstances, and try not to feel exasperated at him. After Jenkins, a grand affair of a ball the pioneers came off at the Occidental some time ago. The following notes of the costumes worn by the belles of the occasion may not be uninteresting to the general reader, and Jerkins may get an idea therefrom. Mrs. W.M. was attired in an elegant pate de foie gras, apostrophe made expressly for her, and was greatly admired. Miss S. had her hair done up. She was the center of attraction for the envy of all the ladies. Mrs. G. W. was tastefully dressed in a tout ensemble, apostrophe, and was greeted with deafening applause wherever she went. Mrs. 100. N. was superbly arrayed in white kid gloves. Her modest and engaging manner accorded well with the unpretending simplicity of her costume, and caused her to be regarded with absorbing interest by everyone. The charming Miss M.M. B. appeared in a thrilling waterfall, whose exceeding grace and volume compelled the homage of pioneers and emigrants alike. How beautiful she was! The queenly Mrs. 50. R. was attractively attired in her new and beautiful false teeth, and the bon jour effect they naturally produced was heightened by her enchanting and well-sustained smile. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.